This Bible verse today, you know, where should God be worshipped, and the answer that's given, it's referenced that it was the woman of Samaria who asked Jesus the question, and it was to her that he gave the answer. The story about the woman of Samaria is relatively well known in the Bible, but the interpretation that Master Paramhansa Yogananda put on that story is not as well known, and even if it is, it's worth going over again. Jesus was traveling with a band of his disciples from one part of where they were to another. He spent a great deal of the 3.5 years of his ministry traveling around the area. They didn't have the internet then, and he couldn't just preach in one place and be heard. The only way he could reach people was to physically go from place to place. So a lot of the Bible is they go to here and they go to there, and he sends his disciples out. He organized his disciples, and he sent out an advance team to publicize his coming, literally. And then he would go and speak, and the whole town would be ready, and the word of mouth would pass, and the miracle worker was coming. And in this way, with the area that he could reach, with his own physical body traveling, the message was spread, and his vibrations and his darshan, the sight of his holy presence, his light was given. And in the Bible, it says he was going from here to there, and he must needs go through Samaria. And we presume that means that the road cut through Samaria, which was a particular town, which was not considered to be a particularly holy or uplifted place. And one always just simply reads that is that geographically he had to walk through the town. You know, to get from here to the front door, I have to go down the aisle. But Yogananda starts his interpretation of the story of the woman of Samaria right at that point, because he said it wasn't that he had to geographically go that way, is that Jesus was inwardly compelled to go to Samaria. And then when he gets to that place, and there is Jacob's well, which in the very ancient tradition of the Jewish people was a holy place from a long time ago. Jacob was one of the spiritual forefathers of those people, and Jacob's well was a particular place, and that's why in this commentary Swami adds, do you go on pilgrimage, do you go to holy places? And the woman of Samaria in the expanded section this is about talks about, this is Jacob's well, this is a place where my people have come for a long time, the water here is good. And that was because the discussion was also about Jesus saying, you drink water from this well and you'll thirst again, but if you drink the water that I give you, you'll never thirst again. She responds, but this is Jacob's well. We've been using it for a long time. The water here is good. I mean, this is how the mind works. But in any case, even when he got to Samaria, Jesus, his disciples went off to go shopping somewhere to get some food, and Jesus stayed back alone. Now again, Master puts significance on this, because there he was next to Jacob's well, and the woman of Samaria, that's how she's called in the Bible, comes and meets him there. Now, he begins to talk to her. They get into a conversation, and it's just the two of them. And he asks her for a drink of water. And he being clearly a Jew, and she being a Samaritan, there were all sorts of rules about who could give whom what, and what kind of water you could drink, and if someone touched it, did it become unclean? Because the whole Jewish ritual at that time was very specific. So he asks her for water, and she says, but I can't really give you water, I'm a Samaritan. He says, go ahead, give me water, it'll be fine. And then he says, you drink water from this well, you'll thirst again. But if you drink the water that I give you, you'll never thirst again. And she sort of is a little puzzled. But this is good water. My people have been drinking this for a long time. Now, what happens then is suddenly she begins to sense who he is. And she begins to discuss with him more serious spiritual questions. And this just comes out of nowhere, seemingly out of nowhere, except out of some intuition on her part that she's not dealing with an average traveler. You know, you meet people, they look you in the eye, you feel their vibrations, and you may know suddenly that you're talking to someone of a particular type, either attractive, unattractive, refined, unrefined. I'm sure we've all had these experiences of just suddenly knowing who someone is by means other than just verbal conversation or the presentation of a resume. So this woman of Samaria and Jesus are suddenly talking about holy subjects, and she begins to ask him questions. And he says, I will be happy to teach you this, but before I teach you, you should go and bring your husband so I can also speak to him. And she says, I have no husband. And then Jesus looks at her again and says, you've answered me honestly. He said, in fact, you have had five husbands, and the man you are living with now is not your husband at all. Now, that clearly indicates this woman has had, let's say, a checkered past. She hasn't been living necessarily by the straight and narrow, but she's said nothing to Jesus to indicate that this is who she is. He asks her a simple question. She gives him an honest answer. He responds, that's very good. You have answered me honestly. And then she becomes completely entranced by him because he's indicated, and this is all that's reported in the Bible, perhaps that more transpired, but she has felt him looking right into her soul and knowing exactly who she is. And he begins then the rest of the conversation. How do we worship? Where do we go? Some say we should go to Jerusalem, some not. And then he speaks of spirit and truth. And she becomes completely uplifted by this experience and runs to tell everyone else in town that this prophet has come who knows everything about me and is going to tell us the real truth about spiritual life. And in fact, Jesus lingers in that place for some days, and everyone comes to learn from him. Now, Jesus' other disciples come back, and Jesus is now in a very uplifted mood. And Master explains the reason is that this woman of Samaria was a disciple of Jesus from former lifetimes, and that she had fallen from the path, obviously by temptation of various kinds. Who knows what had first drawn her off, but the life that she's living now, where she's had five husbands and she's living with a man that she's not married to, and she's in this village, which is not considered to be a very elevated place anyway. But Jesus must needs go and find her, because on some deeper than some inward level, he's incarnated in this world and he's come to take care of his disciples. And we often think that the disciples of a great master would be all the most important people in a place. You know, the rich, the successful, the wealthy. After all, this is a great avatar, and here's the world. You would think power would meet power. But it's actually rather interesting that the people who are drawn often most sincerely and most deeply to a path like self-realization, which is what Jesus came to bring them, the same teachings that Yogananda brought, are usually not those for whom life is working just fine. What draws us to seek an alternative always is the heart has received some blow of one kind or another, or many blows, and that one way or another we've been forced to think, you know, what is life for? What is the purpose? As we say in the Festival of Light, everything that I thought was light was but darkness. Who am I in reality? For what end was I made? And that causes us to go looking for an answer other than the obvious. So the woman of Samaria was that kind of a disciple, and Jesus must needs go and find her. That's why he came to this earth. And when the disciples come back and they've gone to get supplies and they want to give him food, and he's not hungry. And he says, I have meat to eat that ye know not of, is what he answers, which means that I'm fed by the joy of meeting this disciple of mine and finding her honest. That little exchange, you have told me the truth. You see, what that was saying to him is that she was now willing to stand in front of the light as she really was. Who knows what had passed before them, where she tried to justify herself or hide herself or not be willing to accept or not being able to recognize him. But she had felt his consciousness, she had recognized who he was, and when he asked her, reveal thyself to me, she revealed herself. So they were reestablished. It's not that the master ever abandons the disciple, but if the disciple is not willing to accept what the master has to offer, then the master must wait. There was a disciple, Señor Cuarón, of masters of Yogananda's in Yogananda's lifetime. Señor Cuarón lived in Mexico. And master said to him, "I lost sight of you for a few lifetimes." That was a sweet way of saying that you lost sight of me. "But I lost sight of you for a few lifetimes, but I'm not going to lose sight of you again." And Mr. Cuarón would often remind Master, "You promise me now, Master." Master said, "I remember, I've promised that I'll never let you get that far away again." But Cuarón was also saying, "I'll never get that far away from you again myself. I will keep a hold of you." So this disciple had wandered, and then Jesus had found her because the time was right. And when he said he was being fed, the disciples not understanding and Jesus not explaining, they thought, well, maybe someone fed him while we were away. He just didn't know that what fed the master was the devotion of the disciples, not the devotion toward him per se, but their own opening up of the heart. So in all of that context, when that woman then says, "What should I do? Where should I worship?" And Jesus answers in spirit and in truth. Where you go, what form you follow, what rituals they are, who you call yourself, all of that is, as Swami writes, there are many different ways for that to express, because there are many different kinds of people in the world, different orientations who enjoy different things. All of these cultural and spiritual traditions, even on the whole planet, and this is just one planet, there are planets all over the place, Master said, that are inhabited with conscious life. Everything in the universe is conscious. But these vibrational patterns are held. We were having a discussion just, we were up at the village just yesterday and for the last few days, because the 19th of May is Swami Kriyananda's birthday, the founder of Ananda. And he's at Ananda Village, which is just a few hours from here. And these last few days have been a birthday celebration for him. And there's an interesting fact about Ananda as a whole, which is even though the percentage of Jews in the whole of America is smaller than this, at Ananda Village it's about 10%. Because who knows why, but there was a whole group of Jewish people sitting in just visiting in Swamiji, and there was like six of us who came from Jewish families and three of the Episcopalians who were over there. And we just started having a discussion, you know, just about Judaism and why Jews are the way they are and so on, just all these different things, you know. It's just a cultural pattern. Because I was born Jewish in order to find my spiritual family, and my spiritual family is self-realization. But there was a certain orientation toward life, a certain way of being trained, of being brought up, that was the vibration of Judaism, and it served me. It served my personal development. The Jewish tradition claims, some traditions claim that there's such a thing as a Jewish soul, but that's not the teaching of self-realization. The teaching of self-realization is when that we are in fact none of these things, absolutely nothing. We are pure consciousness, we are pure Satchitananda. But as we ourselves have to go through these many karmic learnings, we get oriented in certain directions because they help us to have the experiences that we need in order to realize that we're none of these things. It's just as simple as that. We have to have these experiences to realize that this is not me. This is not who I am. This is not really what my consciousness is. It's the most startling thing to when that perception comes to you, whether it comes to you in deep meditation, whether it comes to you just as a flash of understanding, in an experience of nature, in a moment of love, whatever it might be, to suddenly recognize everything is imposed upon us except the actual simple fact of consciousness. And the nature of that consciousness is simply bliss. And all these other things that we become so deeply devoted to, our families, our integrity in the work that we do, our creativity, the recognition, the physical suffering that we go through, the mental confusion that we go through. I had this dream the other night, just crazy dream. I was with a group of people and we were going for a lecture. I was with Swamiji and a group of us were going, and he was giving a lecture in this hall somewhere. And he was giving the lecture at 6:30 in the morning. You know, dreams are goofy this way. We're all walking into the lecture, and then I noticed, this isn't the dream, I noticed this nice restaurant over here. So instead of going to the lecture, I go over here to have breakfast, right? And then I just have breakfast. And toward the end of breakfast, it occurs to me that Swami Kriyananda is giving a lecture over here, and all I did was have breakfast, and I become very panicky because what a dumb thing to do. I become extremely worried about my brain. Like, how could I have forgotten what I was doing? Then, you know, as dreams go, I try to pay the bill, and there's this group of sort of very old ladies who don't know how to take a credit card, and I don't have any money, you know. But the whole dream is just this frantic thing to get out of where I am and get to where I'm supposed to be, you know. And I wake up just so like this. David was so sweet to me. He said, "You would never really do that. You don't have to be afraid, you know, because this great fear comes into you." But there were so many parts of it that were so interesting. The most notable part was I just forgot what I was supposed to be doing. And I realized that's just sort of what it is to get involved in this world, isn't it? And this is what we say in the Festival of Light every week. We're like fledgling birds. We're sent out. Be fruitful and multiply. We're given a holy mission to expand and multiply the gifts that were given us and to share them with all. That's the holy mission we're given by our Creator. But we get out here, so to speak, and we get involved, and we get really interested in a whole lot of other things, and we get really excited by the sort of the sensation, as the little bird describes it, of flying on his own for the first time, and he just forgets that he has a holy mission. He forgets that he's supposed to stay in the light and share the light, and he thinks what this is about is the experiences that I'm having. You know, and we have that wonderful line, "What else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself?" Which is a very convenient line to quote throughout your life whenever you really just want something. You know, I'll take all that cheesecake because what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? You know, even the devil can quote scripture. Of course, it's a rhetorical question in the festival, and the answer is this is not wisdom, but the words work. You can paste them on. But the bird forgets. He just gets engaged. And the sensations he's having are attractive to him. The woman of Samaria had the good karma to have Jesus as her guru in some previous incarnation, in some previous form of Jesus. She was a highly advanced soul. Jesus is an avatar. She loved God enough to have united her spirit with him. And then something else happened. And she got attracted to this, and she got attracted to that, and she thought that was a really good idea. Mr. Quaron had the karma to be Yogananda's disciple, a very advanced disciple in the form, in the life that he lived, that we know him as this. But somewhere along the way, he got interested in this and interested in that. And for three lifetimes, Master couldn't even find him because he had clouded himself. I mean, that's a sweet way of saying it. That master's back, that the disciple had turned his back on the master. Because, as we say also, to all who received him, Jesus gives the power. The master, God, gives you the power to receive him. If you take your cup like this and turn it over, it doesn't matter how much rain is coming down. Nothing will come into your cup. It just can't. But when we turn it upward, there's so many images we use. We think of the lotus flower of the heart with the petals turned down, and then we visualize the petals opening up. We think of holding up the cup of our spiritual longing and asking God to fill it with grace. All these different ways of saying it, but all of it involve an action on our part to reach up. And what's so sweet also about this story of Samaria is that the woman's life was not orderly. She hadn't herself, like, pulled it all together. But somewhere deep within her heart, obviously she had repented. Obviously she was feeling inside, Lord, I remember what I used to have. I remember what I used to have. There's this story about one of the disciples of Master, a direct disciple of Master, very advanced woman disciple, who was with Master from the early 20s. But somewhere in the middle of that, she decided she wanted to get married. Master thought it wasn't such a good idea for her to do that, but she wanted to do it, and she was strong-willed. She went off, she got married, she got pregnant, she had a daughter. It proved to be not really at all what she'd hoped it would be, because Master knew it wasn't really the right thing for her spiritually. So the marriage ends in divorce, and she picks up the child, and she just comes back to the ashram. This was before Mount Washington was as formal as it is, and she just arrives back with her child in tow. And one of the more sanctimonious people there said, how dare you come back after having defied the Master in this way, with all the evidence right there. You know, it wasn't as even as if she could pretend. And that disciple, the woman just looked right at the other disciple and said, what do you want me to do? Worship my mistakes? You know? Yes, I didn't behave in the way that I should have. I went in a direction that turned out not to be really in my best interest. But should I just keep going in that direction? Of course not. Let me turn my consciousness back where I'm really trying to be. And Master just welcomed her back with open arms. Think about how much the Masters have witnessed. You know, recently we were doing the Easter story. Jesus, one of the 12 apostles, gets it into his mind that it's going to be a good idea to turn his own master into the authorities. Judas had some idea why that was a good thing to do. He hadn't even actually even lost faith in Jesus. He just wanted to push Jesus to declare himself in power and glory. And he thought if he backed him into a corner with those who were arresting him and those who opposed him, that then Jesus would come forth with his power. Of course, Jesus didn't. You know, Jesus allowed himself to be arrested and crucified. And as soon as Judas saw what a horror story this had turned out to be, he committed suicide. And the reason he killed himself is because he saw how wrong he had been. But Master said, this last century, Judas, after having expiated that error, had come through that and was incarnated and was a disciple of Ramakrishna, acting for Jesus, and was liberated. You know, he lost sight of his master for a while, but he came back. You know, because the only thing that matters is that we worship God in spirit and truth. I mean, the question here is asked, what religion, what ritual, you know, what pilgrimage spot? But the real answer to it is the only thing that matters is your consciousness. Nothing else endures. Nothing else even exists. These bodies that we cling to, these lives that we're so proud of, these houses that we cultivate, this money that we have, these relationships that we nurture, I mean, all of them are a superficial form on the essence of who we are. Now, it doesn't mean that the consciousness we develop disappears, or the love and connection and loyalty and friendship disappears. Because the interconnectedness among souls is one of those realities that goes on and on and on and on through all of our incarnations. Just as the Master and his disciples are tied to each other, the whole spiritual family is tied to each other. And every love relationship that we have continues. But the form of I did this and you did that and I'm a man and she's a woman and this is my child and this is my mother. And once a young man at Ananda Village fell in love with this woman, and it was just a very inappropriate match. And Swami Kriyananda had to say, you know, first of all, it wasn't reciprocated, and second of all, it just wasn't an appropriate connection. And the young man protested, and he said, well, if I'm not meant to be with her, why is it that when I look into her eyes, I feel such a deep connection? Swamiji's response was, this is a very old spiritual family. He said, if you look into the eyes of anyone here, you will feel a very deep connection. And the second thing he said was even more interesting. He said, this is a very old spiritual family. We've been all things to one another. You know, everyone has all of these interrelationships over many, many lifetimes. But not all of those forms, all of that, not all of that karma is the dharma of the moment, is the way to put it. Dharma meaning the actual duty to be expressed. Because the real dharma of what we're doing is to withdraw ultimately from all of those forms and live only in the consciousness. Only in the consciousness of bliss, of unconditional love. That's what it is to worship God in spirit and in truth. And that doesn't mean that in all circumstances we're kind and then that we're nice to everyone and that we allow everybody to do everything they want and that we're always accommodating. You know, the pictures we have, the examples of the masters that we get, they're often in tremendous controversy and they often have to take very strong stands. And there's many stories about Yogananda's life in which he, you know, declared during the Depression, Swami tells us these stories on several different occasions. Master was in front of crowds of rich people and just declared, God is not pleased when his rich children take all the resources and his poor children are starving. You know, and that's not you. And he was at a society party once and they asked him to speak. And he said, really, you shouldn't ask me to speak. And the host said, no, Yogananda was very famous. No, you really should speak. He said, you're not going to like what I have to say. Oh, yes, get up and speak. And he stood in front of, I think it was in New York City, in a very wealthy crowd, and this was during the 30s. And he said, you people have been given so much and you're wasting your lives on superficial things. You're spending all your time just, he said, drinking and chasing each other's wives. He said, God is not pleased with this. You know, he didn't mince words. He didn't feel like he needed to be nice. He was spirit and truth. And he acted as God wanted him to act. So make no mistake, when we live in that light, one of the manifestations of God is divine power. That power is exercised only appropriately when it's harmonized with God's will. But this is not a path where we get to just drift through in what Swamiji calls the sort of vague, illusory, subconscious things that we think are the visions of the divine. That's not at all true. It's spirit and truth. And truth is very, 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 very powerful. But the other aspect of it is nothing else really matters. Take care of our consciousness. And you know, people will do what they're going to do. Everybody has their own karma to act out. It's just going to be acted out in front of us. Master, in his life, was persecuted many different times. He had lawsuits. He had yellow journalists. He had people trying to smear his name. You know, the love cult of Mount Washington and things like that. When he went back to England, back to India, the British police followed him all over India. They sent reporters to him. They sent a woman to him who was supposed to find a moment when she could grab Yogananda and kiss him. And then they had a photographer who was going to take a picture like this. And when that woman came near him, Yogananda picked her up by the waist and held her over his head and then turned to the photographer and said, take your picture now. You know, it's a little bit hard when someone's omniscient to trick them. But there's power there too. So when we worship God in spirit and in truth, don't think of it as less by any means. It's bringing everything to a focus deep within ourselves and saying to Divine Mother, whatever I came here to do, I will do. Whatever you ask of me, I will do. Whatever is required of me, to become one with your infinite light, I will do it. Now, sometimes we have to work ourselves up to having the courage to give ourselves to God that completely. But nothing less will ever satisfy us. We imagine that this is about God punishing us. Not at all. This is about the heart finding its true home in bliss. And nothing less will fulfill us. And so Divine Mother knows that. And inch by inch, she pushes us or pulls us or burns us or blesses us. But one way or another, she says, you will come home to me.